Good morning. What must it be like to walk in the shoes of the Taoiseach and Tánaiste? One minute you're mixing it with high flyers on the European stage, marking the end of Ireland's presidency. The next, you're facing into a standoff with your junior minister for European affairs and Fine Gael backbenchers wrestling with their conscience on the abortion issue. On Monday, Lucinda Creighton outlined her reservations during the committee stage of the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, accusing her colleagues of groupthink.
I've never regarded myself as a pro-life campaigner. I was not motivated to become active in politics because of the abortion issue. In fact, I've spoken previously about the fact that I had a very different view on this topic when I was a student. However, after much reflection, my views have evolved over the years. As I learned more about the topic, as I came into contact with friends and family affected by abortion, and as I matured and developed my own independent analysis of this most sensitive topic. Crucially for me, I stepped outside the groupthink, which I genuinely believe dominates this debate in Ireland. It seems that if you don't succumb to the accepted view that abortion is a liberal issue, a women's rights issue, a cornerstone of the progressive agenda, then you are deemed to be a backward, illiberal, Neanderthal fundamentalist who belongs to a different era. Of course, the distinct irony of this prevailing view is that it is so illiberal in its intolerance of any alternative outlook.
The legislation passed this stage by 138 votes to 24, and while Lucinda didn't jump, for now anyway, four of her Fine Gael colleagues did: Peter Matthews, Billy Timmins, Brian Walsh and Terence Flanagan. And just like party politics in the old days of defection, retribution was swift, with the gang of four being expelled from the parliamentary party.
The Taoiseach has made it clear what his position is, that he views it as a matter of party discipline on this legislation, as indeed he does on all of the other difficult decisions we've had to take.
In relation to those who voted against and who may vote against, it is painful, isn't it, for you to hear somebody who's doing what they're doing on the basis of conscience, and also, as Billy Timmins reminded us earlier, on the basis of promises made by many Fine Gael TDs and notably, of course, by Phil Hogan, that you would not do what you are doing, legislate for abortion. That's what the voters were told, but you're doing the precise opposite.
Just 2 points on that. First point in relation to conscience. My own view is that conscience applies all of the time in all of the decisions that we take in government. Many TDs made this point during the debate. Conscience is something that we bring to every decision. I bring my conscience to my support for this legislation. The women who make decisions bring their conscience to the very difficult decisions they have to make. The doctors whom we are mandating in this legislation in a very careful way, they bring their conscience. So I believe that conscience in all of the decisions we make in government is of course a key factor.
Minister Francis Fitzgerald with Cathal McCullough. But next week is the report stage and the debate will be hot and heavy. RTE's political correspondent David McCullough gauged the mood in Leinster House.
Acres of speculation this morning about how many other Fine Gael TDs will join the whipless four. What's your own read?
I think maybe two, maybe three, possibly four at the outside, but probably not going much further than that. The TDs that people are talking about in terms of possibly voting against on report stage, probably next week when it comes to a vote, people like Michelle Mulhern of Mayo, John O'Mahony also of Mayo, John Paul Phelan of Carlow Kilkenny, James Bannon, possibly question marks over Sean Conlon of Cavan Monaghan as well. But really the question mark, the big question mark, is over Lucinda Creighton, the Junior Minister for European Affairs and TD for Dublin South East. She was, in her speech in the Dáil on Monday, very critical of the legislation. She did set out a number of areas where she wanted to see amendments, the clear implication being if she didn't get those amendments that she wouldn't vote in favour of the legislation at report and final stages. There's certainly no indication as of yet that the kind of far-reaching amendments that she was looking for, on particularly on the issue of the inclusion of suicide as the grounds, or the threat of suicide as the grounds for an abortion, it doesn't look like there's any chance of her getting that. The question is, has she walked herself so far out on a limb that she'll have no option but to vote against?
From Wednesday's Morning Ireland. It was the death of Savita Halappanavar at University Hospital Galway last October which many say forced the government's hand to legislate on abortion. Savita was 17 weeks pregnant when she miscarried. The HSE review found that passive approaches and delays in aggressive treatment contributed to her death from septic shock. Her husband, Praveen, has again called for a public inquiry into Savita's death and now intends to take a case for negligence against the HSE. He spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan.
We wanted to get to the bottom of the truth, and the inquest had certain boundaries, which we do appreciate and do understand. Still, someone has to answer why she died.
And you feel you haven't got an answer to that yet?
Yes, I haven't got the answer yet.
And what would you say maybe to the HSE report's findings, that it was almost systemic at the end of the day? It was systemic failure and no particular individual was at fault?
It's basically the report itself was very anonymous. You know, I think it's a complete whitewash, basically. You know, it's more like an audit report rather than identifying the truth or the cause of the death.
As you can imagine, life for Praveen is still unbearably raw.
Do you sometimes wake up, Praveen, and think, has this all been just a terribly bad dream?
Well, I hardly sleep, you know, to wake up and dream about it. That's something I'm still working on. So it's been a very tough journey so far.
Because this time last year, I think Savita was just pregnant. She'd have been about a fortnight pregnant with all the joy that you were both looking forward to.
Yes, I mean, we had, various different plans, you know, like any young couple. I still can't remember everything that we discussed, So it's been very hard.
And Praveen told Miriam how Savita's family reacted to evidence given by midwife Anna Maria Burke at the inquest. It was she who admitted she told Savita she couldn't have a termination because, as she put it, Ireland is a Catholic country.
They wanted to single her out for praise.
Yes, basically they do appreciate anybody talking or speaking the truth, which, you know, has helped them in some way, basically. You know, it gives some kind of satisfaction that somebody has spoken the truth, because why would we come up with that story that it's a Catholic thing and, we would never do that. So it was a big relief for the whole family, do appreciate that particular midwife who's been so honest. And we do understand it's very, very difficult for someone to come out and tell the truth. It came out of blue.
That HSE report also talks about some of the staff in Galway receiving abusive and verbal abusive letters. Were you aware of that they had been receiving abusive letters and abuse in the street?
Yes, I did read it in the newspaper, and even I have been receiving abusive letters. And
you have?
Yes, I have been, from different campaigners, and there is one particular campaigner that keeps writing again and again. So basically I was told to leave the country, and I was told to clean the mess our country has, rather than cleaning the mess here, to live with the, stuff for them to clean and mind my own business. It's hurting, basically. It's not...
That's quite shocking.
Yes, it is.
What do you say to people who believe there's some kind of an agenda at the back of this to try and introduce abortion on demand, and although they would have sympathy for you, would say, oh, this is all a bit of a coincidence, and they think you're in fact being used by a pro-abortion lobby?
Well, all I can say is, I've never been, for the abortion thing, and, we've never, advocated or participated in any of the abortion debate, or we don't follow that. All we are here is, to get to the bottom of the truth, and the whole family wants that no woman, has to go through the same pain that Savita had to go through, and, no family go through the circumstances that we had to face.
And Praveen spoke about the legal action he intends to take.
Do you think Savita would want you to take this case?
Yes, very much.
Why?
Because she was that kind of a person who was always, had a million-dollar smile on her face, and she was always, she wanted always good things to happen to everyone around her, and so we don't want any woman to suffer the way Savita did.
Those people in Galway who are suffering from stress are probably hoping it will all go away, it will end, and that you don't pursue it anymore. Would you assume that's what they're hoping?
The way I put it in short is, tell me the truth and it'll all be over. There are some midwives who never attended the inquest. It still bothers me.
Praveen Halappanavar, who spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan in Galway. The Irish Youth Choir is made up of singers aged 18 to 28, and they're performing in a series of concerts this month under the artistic direction of Greg Beardsill. Evelyn O'Rourke caught up with two of the singers for Wednesday night's Arena.
Singer Robbie Blake has been in the choir for some years now, and he credits the experience that he's had with Greg and the other singers for helping him choose to pursue a professional career in music.
I think most of my initial passion and kind of desire to be a musician came from being in Irish Youth Choir way back when, and being absolutely immersed for 8 or 9 hours a day or something like that. So it's an extremely intense experience from the get-go. You have to learn to love it or else you'd hate it, basically.
But while the choir is busy preparing an ambitious programme of music this week, it's not all hard work, as Leanne Fitzgerald assured me.
Oh, well, we're encouraged to have a lot of water and a lot of rest. Not really much chatting is really allowed, but we kind of get over that.
You struggle with that instruction.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can kind of hear it in my voice at the moment. I mean, it's so hard to try avoid the sing song. How many times are you going to be with as many talented people in one room and not have a sing song?
So what has been the highlight so far for Leanne in her work with the youth choir? Well, surprisingly, it involves the Electric Picnic last year.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Irish Youth Choir!
We were so honoured to be on stage with Elbow. I mean, they're amazing. And the atmosphere and the crowd was absolutely huge. I couldn't believe it. I was so happy.
It's on the corner again. Lippy kids on the corner begin, settled in life.
Elbow, ending Evelyn O'Rourke's report for Arena, and you can catch the Irish Youth Choir and the Ulster Youth Choir at Christchurch Cathedral, Dublin, on the 27th of this month. Kerry teenager Donal Walsh packed a lot into his life. He died of cancer in May, just a month short of his 17th birthday. But he left a very powerful legacy. His message to vulnerable teenagers was simple: choose life and not suicide. Miriam O'Callaghan visited Donal's parents, Elma and Finbar, in their home in Blennerville, and they talked about the foundation they're setting up in Donal's memory to raise funds for teenage hospice care and suicide awareness. And they also spoke of their son's bravery when, after 4 years of battling cancer, he was faced with his own death sentence.
He ended up in the hospital, and he complaining of his sore shoulder.
Not overnight.
No, he wouldn't stay.
He wouldn't stay the night for them.
He wouldn't stay overnight. His shoulder was sore. And again, the pain just wasn't going away. So back up to Crumlin, and they did an x-ray and found that there was another tumour there. And
The following week they did a full body scan in the Hermitage, and when we found out we had 5 different areas of the body were affected, and they said, look, we've given you the Rolls Royce, we've given you the Jaguar of chemos, anything else we've got, it's like a Fiat or a Toyota version of it, and it wouldn't have any effect, and we'd only be prolonging agony, and there's nothing that they could do. So literally he got his death sentence.
Donal himself writes about the day, I think, you were on the phone about that death sentence. He said he came into the room, you were there with his Uncle Brian, and Brian tried to get him out of the room because he knew by your face that it was really bad news.
That's right. Michael rang with the result of the scans, and he said, look, he said, there are 5 tumours. There's one in each shoulder, there's one in the elbow, the left knee, the ankle.
And there were 2 scars on his... and ribs.
2 small nodes on his ribs. And he said, look, he said, there is nothing else we can do for him. And then he said, time-wise, he said, about anything, he said, it would be
we'd be lucky to see Christmas.
He said it would be months more than weeks And he said it wouldn't be a year, and he couldn't put a time frame on it. And by the look on my face, Donal knew that there was something, and Brian tried to get him out of the room, but Donal said no, he wanted to hear. And he wanted to hear it all. He could look at the big picture then and see where he had to go himself.
It was a wonderful conversation about Donal's love of Munster rugby, his campaigning spirit, how he was no saint.
He was a gentle giant, and he just had a kindness about him and sort of his... I don't think I was ever angry at God. I was very angry at cancer. The very first time I remember the feeling that sort of if I could go in there and bite it out and take it in myself, I would do it. That was the viciousness of the disease. Not to be.
Finally, how are you both now?
Good days and bad days. You know, it's still a bit of a roller coaster. You can be fine, absolutely fine, and you think, God, you know, I'm great today. Jesus, you know, I might be moving on a step, and then the next day you're going two steps back. But that's going to happen because we miss him terribly.
Yes, he's also left us a challenge and a legacy that has to be honoured. And there are so many people trying to get us to do things or get to do things for it or to attribute to him or give gifts. We have to tap into it somehow, so we have to start organising ourselves for it as well. So, I mean, he's left us a lot of work.
Do you both think he'll meet up with him again one day?
Oh, yeah.
And he'll probably give out to us.
He'll be waiting for us.
Miriam O'Callaghan with Elma and Finbar Walsh, remembering Donal Walsh. Joanna Reardon is another crusading teenager. At 17, she's already addressed the United Nations in New York, faced down the government on disability rights, and has been named Young Person of the Year. And, oh yes, she was born without arms and legs. She's soon to be the subject of a documentary made by her brother called No Limbs, No Limits, but she still finds time to rock it out there in the free world.
You write, you blog, you tweet. Explain to people how you physically do that.
It's kind of unbelievable to most people, but like whenever I pick up my phone, I use my top and bottom lip to send a tweet. I'm kind of looking at it here now with the temptation to not touch it. Yeah, but that's basically how I do it. And sometimes I use my nose. My mother didn't see me using my nose until like recently, so that's kind of new as well. It's kind of weird because like whenever we're like doing something, like if we're ever doing an app or something, like if it's something to do with drawing, I draw my nose. And like, not saying that I'm like Da Vinci or anything, but I'm pretty good for drawing with my nose.
Which is great. You're funny though, Joanne. I love, you said this kind of perks to the different life that you have to lead in terms of you get to meet One Direction, you can skip queues, you get tickets to gigs. Is that right?
Yeah, like, I mean, Jesus, I mean, you get kind of loads of perks at it. I mean, like, I remember when me and my friend Eleanor wanted to meet Jedward, we got my brother Stephen to email the manager, and we did that whole sob story of, like, she has no limbs, this would make her life, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then everyone, like, kind of feels sorry, and they're like, oh, we should really give her this meet and greet.
So you use it as much as you can.
Yeah, we use it all the time. But, like, sure, like, when you have it, you might as well use it to your advantage.
Lucky to be a friend of yours, Joanne, because if you go along with you, you get the perks as well.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, last night we were a passenger and we got free tickets to that. So I remember, like, we're on the way out and my cousin Denise, my friend Aisling, were just sitting there going, like, I love you. Like, why are you here? I love you.
Joanna Reardon heard on the John Murray Show with Miriam on Wednesday. It's a massive weekend in sport, but a nation mourned and the Twitter machine went into overdrive when news broke on Wednesday that coach Warren Gatland had dropped Brian O'Driscoll from the Lions squad to play Australia in the final test match this morning. And we all felt the hurt and humiliation when it became clear that there wasn't even a role for him on the bench. Eyebrows were also raised with the blend of the team, 10 Welshmen. Des Cahill and Gavin Jennings were exercised.
Interesting quote from Australian great Tim Horan talking about Warren Gatland selecting 10 Welshmen. He says, Gatland has rolled the dice and returned to the Welsh formula. It's a bit like taking your own Weber barbecue over to a mate's place. He's saying, OK, I'm going to stick with what I know.
Jones, Jones, Jones,
yeah,
Jones.
That's right.
And while we know that there's no such thing as sentiment in sport, there was still outrage at the decision. Pádraic Lodge spoke with RTE's rugby analyst and former Lion, Donal Lenehan.
With Sam Warburton out of the side, Paul O'Connell injured, everybody expected Brian O'Driscoll to lead the side. I think Warren Gatland, he's gone now for sheer power and physicality, and he's sacrificed the subtlety and the skills that Brian O'Driscoll brings to the mix. So I am very surprised that he's out of the side, and I have to say, knowing Brian for as long as I do and being out here 14 years ago with Ireland when he was first picked for his first international cap, and here with him in 2001 with the Lions, I feel extremely sorry for him. But you know, there is no sentiment in sport, but I do feel he is still worthy of his place in the side. You know, I find it a bit strange, only a week ago the number of players who sort of name checked Brian coming up to the second test, which of course everybody was hoping would be the deciding test of the series at the time. Everybody wanted to do it for him, given that was his fourth tour and his last tour. Things didn't go his way in the second test, but I mean, a lot of that was outside of his control. I thought the manner in which the Lions played, they played a very negative game and kicked away a lot of possession, so he wasn't given that many opportunities to do what he does best. So it is a shock.
Many analysts believe that Warren Gatland has handed the victory to Australia, and let's face it, we'll soon know. Meanwhile, Oliver Callan has gained access to Warren Gatland's telephone message machine.
Warren here, leave a message. I'm up to my tats, or riff head a fittits, as they say in Wales.
Warren, look, I know I'm not on the team now. I'm pretty devo. Amy's making sheep jokes. Sadie won't settle. Bodocalypse is trending on Twitter. And Hitler's made a YouTube video. Still, best luck on Saturday. Thanks, man.
Look, if you're one of those bloody Irish hicks, there's a very simple reason he's not in the squad. And it's because Dua Diem and Ginrag. It's because he's not Welsh, right?
Gatland, you big rump-faced Antipodean twit. You've outraged the planet. Have you seen the news from Egypt? They're marching again. They want to overthrow you. By the way, the lovely Ingrid says I'm never eating another kiwi again because you've made my gout flare up.
Warren, it's Roy here. So you've sent home Ireland's talismanic player right when the world needs him most. Have you f***ers learned nothing? You're a crap player, and you're a crap manager. You're not even British or Irish, you Kiwi b***ard. I only hope Bod gets an interview with Tommy Gorman fast, then you'll be sorry. F***ing prick.
Hi, Gatty, this is Tom Jones. I hear you're giving any Welshman a jersey for the last test. Any chance of a game, son? I'm available, call me back. Oh, and there's a few Irish outside your place, and they're burning down your house. Yeah.
Oliver Callan and Bod fans heard on Callan's Kicks last night. But rugby isn't the only game this weekend. There's also a big All-Ireland hurling qualifier, Kilkenny against Tip at Nolan Park. Des Cahill gazed into the crystal ball with analyst Michael Dignan.
So what's your fancy, Kilkenny or Tip?
I think this game, you know, in a qualifier, it's such a huge game and it's very hard to call it. But I feel, you know, Kilkenny have had so many injuries. What team could cope without Michael Fennelly, Henry Shefflin, Paul Murphy, and I think a few of the other players are carrying injuries. And then the Tip team, question marks over the character. And I think you see the team that Tipperary picked, they've gone for, you know, the likes of Owen Kelly, Larry Corbett, you know, they're taking no chances, they're going with the experience. So in Nolan Park, the home crowd, I just think it might be enough for one last effort from Kilkenny to get them over the line. I just think that they'll fight on their backs down there. But I also expect Tipperary, you know, to put up a big performance. And I just think Kilkenny maybe could scrape over this, and all of a sudden they could be everyone's favourites for the Ireland again come Sunday morning.
Yeah, it's amazing. What about Clare and Laois in the qualifiers?
Yeah, Laois made great, fantastic progress, and Clare a big setback to last day. So I think Laois will do very well there. I predicted that actually before the Galway game. I thought it was a big performance in it, but you'd expect that Clare should come through in that one.
In the Ulster semi-final replay, it's Derry and Down.
Yeah, I fancied Down last week. Derry put up a huge performance, but I think Down in the replay will get the better of that one.
And that brings us then to the Leinster final on Sunday, Dublin and Galway.
Yeah, almost forgotten about it, I think, as with the build up to Kilkenny and Tip, and I suppose that's understandable. But Galway have been so quiet, just the one game against Laois, and they love that coming in, and they are the team, I suppose, that have over the years come in under the radar and put up a huge performance in Croke Park. But I really like what I've seen with Dublin this year. They started so poorly, lacking confidence really against Wexford, but once they got over that into Kilkenny matches, they've raised the game. None of these players have ever won a Leinster Championship. The hunger is going to be huge. I think their confidence is high, and you know, I think they'll play very well, and notwithstanding that Galway will be favourites, I think that Dublin will do it.
Michael Dignan. Lyric FM last night featured the first of a six-part documentary series called History on a Plate. The idea is to explore recipes from our past to find out more about ourselves. It's presented by Irish Times food writer Catherine Cleary and food historian Juliana Edelman, and chef Dominie Kemp recreates the long-lost recipes. They found this 19th century recipe for oyster sausages in a handwritten recipe book that belonged to a woman called Mary Ponsonby from the collection in the National Library.
Well, I've heard a lot about this book and we've actually cooked some recipes from it, but this is my first time seeing it. And it's a very beautiful book. I mean, you can see from the decoration on the front, it's embossed with her name. It's got these elaborate kind of gilded decorations around the front. It's a red leather binding on it. I mean, it's a very important looking document, really.
Yes, and it's a very big, kind of a hefty book, which is full of extremely small handwritten recipes, and she's got a sort of index in the front. And the old catalogue entry calls it cooking recipes and medical cures, because many of these would have not distinguished between medicinal recipes and recipes for food.
Quite smeared as well, because it was obviously a working cookbook and lots of smudges on it. And
some of the recipes have attribution. So the very first recipe listed is a recipe by Mrs. Veazey in her Bible, apparently, that she's transcribed.
And it was a gift. The sacred book was a gift to Mrs. Veazey of Lucan from Bishop Morris, a gentleman. There's a lot of preamble before we get to the recipe then, really, isn't there?
Yeah. Shall we look at the recipe that we're looking for then?
Yes,
it's on page 5, I think, actually very close to the start.
So yes, you skin a loin of mutton, weigh it and take the same weight in fresh mutton suet.
Pound them well together and season them with pepper, salt and allspice, pounded very fine. Then cut a good many oysters into little bits, but not too small, and mix them with your meat, and wet them with the liquor of your oysters. Make them into what shape you please. Flour them and fry them in butter.
You're not the only oyster in the stew.
Catherine Cleary, Juliana Edelman and Deran Ivrian heard last night on Lyric FM. I wonder what kind of diet Marie Casey Breen follows. She's a 61-year-old, mother of five, she's a trained nurse and a farmer's wife, and when she survived cancer, she promised herself she'd do the Ironman challenge.
Were you dead after it? I mean, spell out to people the distances, what you physically did.
Well, we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and we made our way down then, and the bell went off at 7 o'clock for 3,000 of us to go into this big lake. And we swam 3.8 kilometres, finishing the last 1,000 metres in the canal. Then we did 180 kilometres on the bicycle, and then we came in and we did a full marathon, 26.2 miles.
Did that not nearly kill you?
I tell you, Miriam, it was sort of like childbirth on the first child.
Without an epidural.
I had awful moments that were tough, And then, like everything else, when it was all over, all you could remember was the good bit, the elation.
Just like childbirth, actually.
Yeah, exactly. You forget all the negative stuff and all the good stuff kicks in, and then you go along on that. And at the moment, that's where I am. I'm absolutely thrilled with myself.
Does it mean a lot to you that you have achieved this?
Absolutely. It didn't matter that I was 61, but it did matter that I had survived cancer and that I had set myself this goal. And I would say to all people who are anyway sick or in any stressful situation, just set yourself a small achievable goal with a hint of a challenge in it and focus on that and achieve it. And it will get you through, really, because most times it's really getting your mindset right for a lot of things in life.
Marie Casey Breen with Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. Ombudsman Emily O'Reilly will be facing a new set of challenges herself in October. She's just landed the prestigious job of European Ombudsman, elected by MEPs and beating off fierce competition. As President Higgins and Taoiseach Enda Kenny congratulated her on her victory, Sean O'Rourke asked her to lay out her stall for the future.
I think the potential lies in the fact that certainly it has struck me very forcibly since I've come here, and obviously from my own knowledge at home as well, the increasing dominance of the EU institutions in the lives of the ordinary people in the member states. And I think there is increasingly a role for, you know, an EU ombudsman to reflect that and to step up the game of the European Ombudsman's Office to make it have greater impact and greater effectiveness. And as I said in several of the hearings that I attended over here, to encourage the institutions institutions to do what they're supposed to do according to their own treaties and according to the Charter of Fundamental Rights.
How big an office is it and how busy is it?
Well, the office is slightly smaller than my own. I think there are about 60 staff in it. It's very busy in terms of the number of people who come to it. Obviously, a lot of the complaints that it gets don't exactly fit into its remit, because sometimes a lot of the people in Europe think that it's a sort of an appeals body from the member states, which it isn't. But increasingly, it's dealing with much more complex complaints. For example, one very interesting one that was dealt with recently involved the European Medicines Agency and a decision by that agency following an investigation by the European Ombudsman to release details of clinical trial data on drugs. And I think, as I said on numerous occasions here, that is a resonance not just for individuals but for lots of people and families right across Europe. So it's really, you know, moving out from, you know, the margins where it's dealing with small individual complaints and dealing with much more meaty issues.
Emily O'Reilly heard on the News at One on Wednesday. I tuned into Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly last week. Apparently, prices for horses and ponies in Ireland are falling through the floor. Frances Shanahan travelled to the horse fair at Spansel Hill in County Clare to check it out.
Trying to buy a cob off a man here now.
He's a nice big hairy cob. Seems very quiet.
That's what I need him for, a quiet horse. It has to be.
Whoop, whoop.
Mind yourself, mind yourself.
No, that wasn't the quiet one.
No.
The historic horse fair has been on the go in Spansel Hill since 1621. And this year, with demand down, Frances found ponies going for a song.
You're trying to sell two ponies. What's the story?
I'm trying to sell two ponies. And I have to get this man back to me quick here. Bring this man back to me here.
He's walked away from you. Are you asking too much?
I couldn't be asking too much. I'm only asking 50 euros each for two ponies. And he's only given me 50 for the two. That's only 25 euros each.
That's insulting.
It's absolutely insulting.
Now, tell me about them. Why are they so cheap?
They haven't much work done. One of them is only a two-year-old, so you'd have to be waiting 2 years. The other one is a mare. She's 8-year-old. She's been ridden and broken, all right, but we haven't done a lot of work with her. She was basically bought for keeping the grass down in the lawn, and now we want to get rid of her, so we have more small ones to keep us occupied.
This place is full of buyers and sellers, and yet you can't offload the two ponies.
And we still can't offload the two ponies. This is the first bid that we have got for the day, and we're here since 9 o'clock.
And as the day drew to a close, had the dealer Frances met had any luck with his two ponies?
You've had a deal. You've done a deal.
I have a deal, but it's only one 50 euro note that I have a collar in my pocket, but we're delighted to get rid of them as well. So I have a 50 euro note here. So we're going to use that to buy petrol for the lawnmower now, so I have to keep it grazed.
That's it. You've actually sold two ponies.
Two ponies for 50 euro.
A buyer's market, if ever there was one. Frances Shanahan, reporting for Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly, produced by Sinead Egan. On Bowman's Sunday 8:30, John Bowman began a four-part series celebrating the broadcasting career of the late Prunchius O'Conlune. Prunchius died last May, well into his 90s, after 36 years working with Radio Éireann in the GPO and then here in Montrose. He began life as a scriptwriter, but became a reporter and producer, song collector and social historian. And he was one of Ireland's finest programme makers, along with the likes of Ciarán McMahona. He's left a fantastic legacy. When he retired in 1983, Mike Murphy persuaded him to talk about his days on the road and the excitement generated when the RTE mobile recording studio rolled into a village for a session.
So what about the outside broadcast unit itself? What did that look like?
Well, the original unit, in fact, was Seamus Ennis's old 14.9 Ford, because we all arrived there in 1947 and there was no actual transport. It just wasn't available or hadn't been rigged up or whatever. It was to be one of the old post office vans, the V8 Ford, which was a huge, ungainly affair.
Yes.
And I remember when it was actually rigged up, you had all the recording discs, cutting equipment. Now, this was in 1948 when it was eventually assembled, and it was all on one side of it, and the operator sat opposite this, and the door opened so that if you're going around a corner somewhere in Donegal at any sort of speed, you were likely to end in the ditch, which indeed we often did. You know, going around Corkscrew Bends, got stuck there and couldn't get any further.
And that's right, because the equipment in the van, you had disc cutting equipment.
Disc cutting equipment.
There was no
yes.
such thing as tape.
no tape until 1951, I think.
So what would you do? The van wouldn't be able to get to certain places. It was
That's
so big.
Right.
So what would you do?
You'd park away down sometimes at the bottom of a lane, and you'd have a cable 100 yards long, possibly. You brought your microphone into the kitchen of the house, and you'd no visual control very often over the recording. And you'd have Johnny Spillane or Jimmy Mahon or Ned Nugent or some of the people who were on the recording end of it in those days. They would be out sitting in the van. You were there, possibly up a laneway. And
with the person who was going
with the person
perform,
who was going to be interviewed or sing or whatever. Yeah. And when you thought everything was ready, you'd say, right, Ned, we'll go ahead 10 seconds from now.
Yes.
And very often, indeed, the first cut wouldn't go well or... The person in the van wasn't ready to go or something
and
else.
It was actually being carved into a disc.
That's right.
As it was being recorded.
And there were 78s, right? The original one, so that you could only take about 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes. And then you suddenly ran out, and it was very difficult to explain to some old man of 80 that you wanted them to go over all that again or start in the
That's
middle
right.
of a story.
That's right.
Former RTÉ Director General Cathal Gowan was a great friend and admirer of Prentice O'Conlon. He first got to know him when Cathal worked in the RTÉ Sound Archives and began to catalogue his work. He was Peter Brown's guest on The Rolling Wave.
From the point of view of people who are interested in linguistics, it was that he recorded Irish in very many places where Irish was dying out. In his own native Tyrone, for instance, in the Sperrin Mountains. He did the same in Rathlin Island off the Antrim coast. He would have sought out people who had remnants of Irish in the glens of Antrim as well. He would have been in various parts of Mayo where Irish has receded even since he made the programmes of Gaeltacht Scoitheann Iarthar in the 1950s. He documented the island life of Inishark and Inish Turk as they were evacuated during that period. He also did the same in Gola in County Donegal. There are so many aspects of that side of it which in themselves constitute kind of ethnological treasures. He was there at a certain time. He recognised the importance of recording people. Unlike, say, for instance, the Irish Folklore Commission, which very self-consciously said, we're going to collect this because it's about to perish, as if that was the main reason for collecting it, Prentice collected because he enjoyed the people. And I think one of the things that comes through in all of those programmes is his enjoyment of people. The chats that he has, and they are chats. He doesn't go for, if you listen back to all that material, he's talking to people. Come here, tell me, I was wondering. And off he goes and engages people at that level rather than tell me a folktale, if you know what I mean. So there was a relaxed quality, yet there was a great perceptiveness in the way that he engaged with all those people over the years, the length and breadth of Ireland, and indeed beyond Ireland, but particularly in this country.
And here's an example of Prentice O'Conlon's style from a documentary he made on flax.
The people all grew flax in those days. In all your life, you never seen as beautiful a sight as to see a large field of flax in full bloom with a nice blue bough on it. It's delightful to look at. I seen 18 flax pullers in the one field, all pulling flax in a row across the field. And there were boys and girls and men and women. And they laughed and some of them sang, the liveliest crowd of people that ever you listened to.
From Bowman, Sunday 8:30 and The Rolling Wave, presented by Peter Brown. And Peter and Kieran Hanrahan will be broadcasting live from the Willie Clancy Summer School in Milltown Malbay this weekend. Lucky, lucky. Katrina Perry has been reporting from Australia all week for Morning Ireland on what life is really like down under for the Irish. On Tuesday, she met Tom and Julie and their three young children, who left Tipperary after Tom's once successful construction business collapsed.
It was going very well, everything was going fine. Then 2008, everything just kind of kicked the bucket. So from 2008 to 2012, you were just kind of living day to day and scraping and scraping and hoping for things to get better, but it just didn't recover.
Apart from sunshine, Perth has also provided a job and a lovely lifestyle.
There's no comparison. At home, you're working all hours God gave you, you know what I mean? Now, generally leave here around 7:15, we work from 20 day till about 5, half 5, depends on what the day or what tenders we've out, and never work a Saturday or a Sunday. So you know, you have your family time, and that's what it's all about. You get your wage packet every Monday into the account, and it's Thanks. I have no regrets. I enjoyed it, to be honest.
But not everyone has been so lucky.
I've had no money, I've had no place to live. It was hard, like, it was tough. One night I slept to the beach, like, or in the car, in the beach. That was the worst, that was the lowest. Like, with $40 left, that was the lowest I've been, like. And again, yesterday, no money left till 7 o'clock. Just had enough money to survive, like, the week. It is tough, like, extremely tough. But there's just no work back home. Nothing at all. I was unemployed for 2 years back home. It's sad, though, the way the country's gone. All they're doing is just shipping them out, like.
From Katrina Perry's special reports from Australia for Morning Ireland. It's been a volatile week in Egypt with the toppling of President Mohamed Morsi in an apparent military coup. On the gathering yesterday, Miles Dungan discussed the situation with Irish Times journalist Mary Minahan and politicians Éan Ariardhon and Pather Tobin.
Are we looking here at a coup, or are we looking here at a phrase which I first heard used this morning and which appeals to me, popular impeachment?
Yes, it's interesting. Like, I suppose we look for guidance in these circumstances to our Department of Foreign Affairs and
Look for guidance to the minister.
Yeah, he has very clearly said yesterday anyone who values democracy cannot be happy with what has happened. And he has used the word coup, but he's a military coup. He seems quite out of sync with some other leaders. And I suppose, you know, pictures of excited Egyptians and enjoying the fireworks in the square and so on after Morsi was toppled are kind of thrilling. But if it is a military coup, I'm not sure if we can use that phrase or not. It's a frightening prospect. This man was democratically elected, the country's first democratically elected leader. You know, on balance, don't get me wrong, it probably is better for Egyptians and the world that he is gone. But I suppose what Mr. Gilmore has said anyway is that elections should be held as quickly as possible to allow Egypt's kind of fragile transition to democracy to continue.
It was a military coup. And Eamon Gilmore is quite right to call it as it is. I think we do need elections as soon as possible. We need to get a parliament up and running in Egypt and a full and equal democracy. But I think Eamon Gilmore did make a very important point, is that, you know, a democracy needs to have equality at the heart of what it does. And the treatment of women isn't very important in that. And there's evidence that women were not particularly well treated in the protests. The one point I would like to make for any Irish citizen who's thinking of travelling to Egypt is obviously to consult with the Department of Foreign Affairs if they are thinking of doing that.
Pather, how do you see it?
Personally, I think it was a democracy. I think it is a coup. I think sometimes the West thinks that its own security is best served by having stable autocracies in the region. I think traditionally in those autocracies, what happens is that Islam becomes the only counterbalance allowed within the countries to the autocracy, and therefore Islam becomes a vehicle for revolutionary change within it, I think.
So in the words of Lyndon Johnson, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Yeah, but I think that serves America and the West in the long run. It serves them bad, because in the end of the day, if you want to create democracies there, it can't be just your type of democracy that you allow. You have to be able to allow for the outcome of the democracy. And if you want to decouple Islam and the revolutionary spirit towards democracy, you have to allow for that democracy to grow for a period of time, and that's not what's happening here.
From the gathering yesterday. Well, we're due a heatwave, and with that, a health warning about the use of lawnmowers from plastic surgeon Patricia Eady, who spoke with Sean O'Rourke on the News at One.
What kind of injuries have been reported?
Well, we've had 4 children in the last 6 weeks who've either had devastating hand injuries or devastating foot injuries. 3 out of 4 have been from ride-on lawnmowers and the other from a push-type lawnmower. So one child has lost all of the digits on a hand and the other child has a really severe injury to their hand. The children who've had foot injuries have lost a number of toes and also a portion of the foot.
What about adult injuries?
We've had a number of adult injuries in St. James's, where I work as well.
The ride-on mowers present a particular problem. Now, what kind of things have happened there? Children have fallen off and been run over by them, or that kind of thing?
They're run over by them. They're just playing around. They're small kids. A number of years ago, had a child who was on it, fell back into it and lost his arm completely. You know, it can be that they're on the lawnmower, or it can be that they're just running around the place. So we'd advise parents, if you are cutting your grass, have a second adult to look after the child, or keep them inside, or do it at a time when the children are otherwise engaged.
Plastic surgeon Patricia Eady. On Mooney on Thursday, 23-year-old boxer Steve Collins, son of the famous Steve Collins, spoke with Derek about starting out on his professional career. His first fight is in London on the 12th of July.
I never get my name. I give my mother's maiden name. I say my name is Stephen Comiskey.
Just
so I didn't want to kind of get, you know, any attention, because I'd be like, oh, this is Stephen's son, let's get some lads in here to try and knock him out.
So you say your mother's maiden name was Comiskey, and did you have a pet when you were a child?
a pet? I know where this is going. I've heard this before.
But if you're going around giving your mother's maiden name, you might as well give it out. What was your first pet's name, just out of curiosity?
Fido, I think, is
Fido Comiskey. Yeah, okay, yeah. I can see it, all right.
Yeah. So I used to call into James and just, you know, ask, like, you know, is there any heavyweights or super heavyweights or, you know, guys I could just get sparring off.
I mean, you're a big guy. You're very fit. How tall are you?
6 foot.
And what weight are you?
I'm not heavyweight. I'm cruiserweight, which is just about under 14 stone, 89 kilos.
Well, why were you looking then for the bigger guys?
Because I was heavier at the time. I've cut a lot of weight leading up to this fight because, you know, cruiser would be my natural weight.
Right.
I was carrying a lot of bulk from playing rugby, you know.
Boxer Steve Collins with Derek Mooney on Thursday. Well, I'll leave you now with a song from Bell X1. It's from their new album and they played live on Tuesday. Gurumahagavas were Goluther, Tasulam Gurwanshev Saltasuglor, Agus Gameshev Lum Takanamakiana, and Tachthan Chahugin, Gajishin, Gajeshab Slan.
Some friends come in and out of view. Last time I looked, we were dancing like dogs on fire. Now I'm laughing with your little girl, laughing about my sunburn on that day. Oh, it's good to see you smile. I remember how I held you as I cried. I'm flailing like a landed fish, trying to get back to before his day went awry. But who would make the cut when our time is up? And everyone pointing at the sky, screaming, the end is nigh, it's coming. Like an explorer clearing ground, swinging your blade, flashing in the sun. You cut right through my moped, pick me up and then was on your way. I treasure the skies, we'll always have. I don't remember where we were, don't think we've returned. These moments are fleeting as they are pure, but I think you'd make the cut when our time is up. And everyone pointing at the sky, screaming, the end is nigh, it's coming. Be a fireball from the sky, or will we all take to the bed, laid low by a new pox? Or will the wrong guy get the codes? Whose arms would I seek? Whose eyes would I meet in the final throes? And say it was good to be human, to be a human with you here. I think you'd make the cut when our time is up. And everyone pointing at the sky, screaming, the end is nigh. Yeah, you'd make the cut when our time is up. And everyone pointing at the sky, screaming, the end is nigh. It's coming, hold me, 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 it's coming.